from KQED.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Angela Kacherga of the Albuquerque Journal and Dahlia Lithwick of Slate about the deepening crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border 1 year after a judge ordered an end to the Trump administration's family separation policy. As accounts of migrant children living in squalid conditions in U.S. custody and an image of a drowned little migrant girl and her father have surfaced. Angela Kacherga, there is talk that that the U.S.'s policy now of slowing down dramatically the ability of migrants to apply for asylum has a direct relationship with this image that has surfaced of the father and little girl who drowned trying to cross the Rio Grande. Do you think that's a fair connection? Are people getting more desperate?
We've seen this consistently. When people can't go through the legal channels, like the ports of entry where they're supposed to appear, and they've been consistently told to go and ask for asylum, they will go out into outlying areas, go around the ports. And, you know, fortunately, up to now, it's been people going through kind of city areas. But as we see more enforcement from Mexico, the National Guard, people are going to be pushed into further and further out into desert areas. And also, right now, this time of year, the Rio Grande really lives up to its name. This is irrigation season. A lot more water has been released. We've got more of the irrigation water from the dam. So people who may have come a month ago, 6 weeks ago, could maybe wade across. Now they're encountering very dangerous conditions in the river and the canals leading into the river. And we've had 7 deaths in the El Paso area, drowning deaths this month alone. One included a young child with her mother. And, of course, we saw that horrible photo of the little boy, I mean, the little girl with her father. And, you know, it's really, people can see these deadly conditions. And it is heartbreaking, but the prediction is we're going to see a lot more. And by comparison, last year in the El Paso area, we had 4 deaths for the entire Border Patrol sector, which includes this little corner of West Texas and all of New Mexico. And here we have 7 just this month.
Well, let's go next to Stephanie in San Jose. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello. So I have a question regarding the first reporter you had on, where he mentioned that these were unaccompanied minors. And my question is how is a 2-month-old baby who can't walk an unaccompanied minor?
Stephanie.
In my mind, anyone under 5 is separated from whoever brought them.
That's a great question. Dahlia Lithwick, yes, they're being described as unaccompanied minors, but children are still being separated, correct, from their families?
They are being separated, and one of the things we learned when we started researching this, and there's a really good piece last week in the New York Times by Michelle Goldberg, if you want to look it up, Stephanie, but I think that one of the things that's been happening is there have been a few loopholes. Even when they said we're going to stop separating families, there are a few loopholes that this administration has absolutely driven a car through and used it as a basis to continue separating kids. And so theoretically, they will separate families if, for instance, the parent has a criminal record or some kind of serious illness. But what we're seeing is kids who are separated from their folks because in one instance, the dad had a littering misdemeanor. People who are separated over incredibly trivial alleged crimes. And those are the family separations that continue. And that doesn't even touch the thousands of families that were separated last year that still have not been reunified.
Yes. Well, Tom writes, $4.5 billion to house, feed and care for non-citizens. How much did Congress allocate for the homeless American citizens who are living on the street? This listener writes, how close can protesters get to these squalid shelters? I'm shocked that there aren't any whistleblowers inside the facilities who are appalled enough to take secret pictures. Are they frisked or something and allowed no personal phones? Think what their pictures could show. Let me go next to Alan in Berkeley. Hi, Alan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Similar to the previous question, I think the media and even your speakers, while they're excellent, are still losing sight of the fact that most of this is a manufactured crisis by the Trump administration, by the deliberate policies that they've set up. When, as I understand, if you look at the monthly numbers compared to the peaks during the Obama administration, yes, they're increased, but they're not increased by that much. But because of the policies and practices that, and the separation that the administration has put in place by not allowing, by requiring fingerprinting and verification of family relationships, just by the separations themselves, they've created the crisis. And the attempt to shift the blame, you know, through the appropriations process is really just that, an attempt to shift blame away from the administration toward the Democrats and saying it's their fault, when in fact I can't believe there's not sufficient funding available in various pots of money within HHS to buy enough soap and toothpaste for these children.
Well, Alan, thanks for your comment. Dahlia Lithwick, can you give us any sense? I mean, speaking of policies, speaking of the situation and how this administration has exacerbated the situation because of some of its policies, do you have any sense of if there's going to be changes to the asylum policy that President Trump has instituted that has dramatically slowed down the ability of folks to make their cases? He tweeted that, you know, Congress needs to work out a solution to the asylum and loophole problems in relation to his earlier call for a massive deportation of undocumented immigrants to be carried out by ICE. I mean, can you shed any light on that?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is a whole web of different problems. And I want to just go one better than Alan and say, not only do I completely agree that these are policy decisions that were made in terms of deportation priorities, in terms of separation and deterrence, I don't think anybody is disputing that these are decisions, policy decisions that were made by the Trump administration. I would go one further and say these are also policy decisions that affect what life is like on a day-to-day basis in Central America, decisions to withhold aid, decisions to threaten to shut the door that are also serving to ramp up the number of people who are seeking to be here. So it's not just the sort of micro policies, but it's the larger failure to aid that I think is certainly creating part of the surge. As to your question about asylum, look, we have a federal court that is assessing whether the Remain in Mexico policy, for instance, is permissible. While that court makes that decision, the Remain in Mexico policy stands. But we do have courts that are trying to check some of these policies. Asylum is meant to be something, both by international treaty and federal domestic law, that you can seek. You don't have to do it the way Donald Trump wants you to do it. So they're being challenged. And I suppose there's some reason to believe that courts at the end of the day will, in a very, very slow, laborious process, check some of the worst excesses. But I think one of the things we're learning, as is with the crisis, the declaration of an emergency, and the building of the wall, so many of these issues implicate this very, very fuzzy space between where the executive branch can operate without Congress's permission and whether the courts will step in. And so many of these immigration cases, including last year's travel ban, after years and years in the court, we find out that the answer is often it's complicated.
Well, Eddie writes, summer is around the corner and temperatures in the region where the camps are located can easily reach 110 degrees during the day. If this administration won't even provide soap, how can we expect them to care enough for these kids so they don't die of heat stroke? Dahlia Lithwick, I know we need to let you go. And I just want to ask you about your piece where you write of a numbness that feels like it has settled in after last year's public outrage. First, can you talk a little bit about why you wanted to raise that and whether or not you see the latest events having an impact or breaking through the numbness?
It's ironically, it's a piece that I linked to in this week's piece that I wrote 1 year ago saying, don't let yourself go numb. We're all going to go numb, and going numb is part of the point. And a little bit at the time, I was reflecting on, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of people who went out to the airports in the first weekend of the travel ban, the thousands and thousands of people who went out for the first Women's March, and just the growing, creeping sense that none of us can do anything about at anything. And if you consider those images that you're describing that are so gutting, even just from yesterday, and the ways in which we're led to feel sort of helpless and hopeless and overwhelmed, I think the only point I was trying to make is that numbness is a one-way ratchet. We don't get less numb. We get more numb. And that we can't change Donald Trump, but we can change ourselves. We have to be really vigilant that the chaos and the distortions and just the absolutely horrifying things that we're seeing don't push us into a place where we fling up our hands and Netflix more. I think we just have to understand that now is the time to act. It was the time to act a year ago.
Dahlia Lithwick, a reporter for Slate who covers the courts and the law, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, Angela Kucherga, Southwest Border Correspondent for the Albuquerque Journal. We appreciate you being on as well.
Thank you. I just add, we're living this on the border. We're witnessing not just photos, but the day-to-day death toll. So it is difficult, and it's important not to go numb because we need people not just on the border but beyond to realize what's happening.
Thank you for that, and thank you to our listeners for your questions and comments. We'll be talking about the presidential candidates debating tonight next, so stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim in for Michael Krasny. The first of two debates between Democrats vying for the White House begin tonight. 20 candidates met the donor or polling requirement set by the DNC to qualify for the debate stage. And the 10 candidates debating in Miami tonight are Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Julian Castro, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke, Tulsi Gabbard, Jay Inslee, Bill de Blasio, and Tim Ryan. So which candidates will you be watching closely? Which issues are you eager to hear them talk about? We're joined by Melanie Mason. She's a politics reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Good morning, Melanie Mason.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And we have our own Marisa Lagos with us, politics correspondent for KQED and co-host of KQED's Political Breakdown podcast. Good morning, Marisa Lagos.
Good morning, Mina.
So the first night, the lineup for the first night, give me your reactions for who you think will do well in this field.
Well, you know, I think that the Democrats were trying to avoid a 2016 Republican, what happened then, which was like this idea that one of the debates was sort of like the kids' table. And in a way, this random drawing kind of ended up like that a little bit, because Elizabeth Warren is really the one to watch tonight, given where she stands in the polls. If you look at the polls both nationally and in some of the early voting states, it's kind of a mix of Biden, Warren, and Sanders leading, depending on where they are. And so I think she's really the one to watch. You know, we do have some other big names here. You mentioned Cory Booker, Beto O'Rourke, Amy Klobuchar, Julian Castro, I think, is a little bit of a sleeper favorite. But, you know, I think that a lot more eyes are going to be on Thursday night, quite frankly, because that's when we will see Biden and Sanders, Buttigieg, Kamala. And you know, I think Biden is the big question mark. He has been leading so many polls. He is sort of seen in a lot of ways as the one to beat. And so I think tonight the question is, how do these other lower tier candidates react to Warren? And do they kind of go on the attack against her, or do they focus on Biden or even Trump? And how much of this is sort of an intra-democratic debate, and how much of it is talking about the border separations and immigration policy and these broader issues that clearly are going to really dominate when we get to the general election.
And so, Melanie Mason, of these, you know, less well-known candidates, who are you expecting to have a breakout night tonight?
Well, I'm hesitant to make predictions because I think we all learned from 2016 that predictions are not a good look for us journalists. But in terms of people I'm interested in, I'm going to second what Marisa said. I'm interested to see where Julian Castro comes out in this. He's been putting out some very interesting policy proposals recently on things like housing, on universal pre-K, on immigration, and has even gotten props from people like Elizabeth Warren, who I think are seen as the real sort of policy workhorses in this race, as advancing ideas that she can agree with. So he's kind of a low-key guy. He's not really a flashy candidate, but he has sort of an interesting intellectual space. And, of course, he's a Latino candidate. And so for voters in California in particular, I think that his ability to take off is really going to be something worth watching.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, I think it is so interesting when you look at, you know, who is leading in the polls in a time when there's so much, you know, talk about people of color and women and identity politics, that, you know, the three top candidates are all white and one of them is a woman, Warren, Biden and Sanders. And so I think Melanie's absolutely right. And just, you know, anecdotally, I've been hearing a lot of interest in the very liberal Bay Area about people like Castro, who isn't the most progressive of the candidates on all areas. He's pretty progressive on immigration, but he has a pretty business friendly sort of background. And so I do think that, you know, that's what these other candidates really are hoping for, is that moment that goes viral that they can, you know, point at and say, look, I am sort of in the top tier with these other people. I have the chops to do the policy debates and to really sort of rise above the rest.
We're doing a quick preview of the first night of the Democratic debates with Marisa Lagos, politics correspondent for KQED and co-host of KQED's Political Breakdown podcast, and with Melanie Mason, politics reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And so, listeners, if you'd like to join in, tell us which candidates you'll be watching closely, what issues you're eager to hear the candidates talk about. Call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, on Facebook. Tweet us at KQED Forum or email us at forum@kqed.org. In terms of issues, Marisa Lagos, I mean, we just did a segment about immigration. How much do you think that will come up, or where do you see some of the most significant policy differences emerging among the candidates tonight?
Yeah, I mean, I think that anytime you have these types of debates, whatever the issue is of the day is going to be sort of one of the first things asked about. And I think that, you know, the crisis that we're really at, the amount of attention it is garnering, and for very good reason, is going to be a big thing. I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see how the Democrats walk this line, because as your earlier guest pointed out, this is not just a problem that was created by the Trump administration. It's clearly been exacerbated by them. But I think that balance and hearing some really sort of articulated views on what these candidates would do, I hope the moderators will push them on that. You know, I think that one area that has gotten a lot of attention between Sanders and Warren's plans is college debt. And I think that that's going to be an interesting one, because that is an area where you do see a lot of daylight between some of these candidates, right? There's questions about this, you know, whether they should be, you know, pushing as progressive policies as both Warren and Sanders are around forgiving past debt, whether it should, there should be means testing. So I think that'll be kind of a fascinating area. you know, you have candidates like Jay Inslee, who are running on a climate change platform. I think that that's something that, you know, I would hope we see taken seriously. And then I think that there's like areas where it's a lot easier for them, because it's going to be, most people are going to be agreeing. If we're talking about, say, reproductive rights, healthcare, I mean, healthcare, not everyone agrees on, but I think the sort of broad brushstrokes are so different between Democrats and Republicans that you're going to see, I think some of these candidates really try to differ themselves from the pack. And I think that that's where, you know, we've seen some of these stories around concern within the Democratic Party that these could sort of just turn into a food fight, and that that would really hurt Democrats if they're kind of seen as having petty snipes with one another instead of really going after Trump. But they all need to knock one another out to get to that point. So it is sort of an interesting balance. And so that's one thing within these policy discussions that'll be fascinating. Like, are they really sort of high level policy questions, or are they turning personal? Does Biden, for example, get attacked over the Hyde Amendment and his past statements about abortion and reproductive rights, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, let's go to our listeners. And Amos in San Francisco, what's on your mind?
Hi, guys. I'm a U.S. military veteran, and I do a lot of work with deported veterans. And these are veterans that served in the U.S. military, are green card holders, and were deported after they were discharged from the military. I'm really interested in hearing Julian's comments, because he is one of the first candidates to come out publicly and state his support for deported veterans and trying to get them back home.
Amos, thanks. Melanie Mason, what's your response to Amos in terms of trying to hear more about support for deported veterans? Again, you know, these questions about immigration coming up.
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting question because I think on immigration, you have all the Democrats generally on the same page when it comes to decrying Trump's policies. But it varies when it comes to sort of proactively advancing immigration plans. So Castro is a good example. He was pretty far out in front in putting together an immigration plan that, as Amos mentioned, does speak specifically to veterans, but also talks about providing aid to Central American countries, for example, that sort of gets to the root cause of this migration. Another person that I think would be worth watching is Senator Kamala Harris, who rolled out a series of proposed executive actions that she could take, basically saying, look, we've been saying forever that Congress needs to pass comprehensive immigration reform. We have not seen any indication that there's an appetite to do so. And so she identified certain executive actions that she can take, much like the Obama administration did with DACA, that could help extend deportation protections and even put people on a path to citizenship. And if I remember correctly, I believe that veterans would fall under that category. So she has very specific policy proposals that can speak to that issue.
Well, Chris in San Rafael, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm just really interested in hearing more about Andrew Yang and his platform. It just seems one of the issues tearing our country apart is just automation and the Amazon, you know, call it Amazon capitalism. There's just not enough jobs, and the candidates really aren't talking about this, except for, I think, Andrew Yang.
Thanks, Chris. And Andrew Yang will be in Thursday night's lineup, as I understand it. But Melanie Mason, any thoughts on Yang and him being a factor?
Yeah, I mean, he has really carved out a niche for himself talking about these concerns over automation. And, you know, he's a big proponent of this idea of universal basic income, which is basically a monthly stipend to everybody in the country as a way to sort of smooth over what could be a very rocky economic transition when it comes to the effects of automation. And, you know, I mean, this is a conversation that is going on in economic circles. A lot of tech founders are proponents of this. And, of course, in you know, even in the Bay Area in Stockton, they are doing a pilot program right now, sort of testing out a universal basic income-like program. So I'm not surprised that Yang has found a following on this, particularly online. It seems like he's really sort of tapped in on, like, the Reddit and Twitter crowd. But I think this will be the first chance that he, and quite frankly, most of these candidates will have to introduce themselves to, I think, the wider American electorate, maybe the folks that aren't super engaged on social media or, you know, following every twist and turn about politics online. I think a lot of people, if you stop them on the street and they only sort of followed politics, they may not know Andrew Yang or Marianne Williamson. And so he really has, I think, a lot of pressure to, in this very first introductory moment, make a good impression.
Well, let's talk for a minute about the logistics of this, given the fact that there are 20 folks who are debating, and that's not even the number of candidates. There are more candidates than that who are trying to run against Donald Trump and trying to get the Democratic nomination. But what do you see, Marisa Lagos, as this, you know, spread out between two nights, 10 randomly chosen people per night? I mean, what are the disadvantages, advantages here of this type of a structure?
I mean, you know, I have to say, and you moderate things as I do, like, anytime you have more than two or three people on a debate stage, I have a hard time even calling it a debate because there's so little opportunity to really get into the weeds on, like, debating between, you know, two of the people. It tends to be sort of everybody fighting for as much of the time as they possibly can. You know, if you're talking about if it was split equally, they'd only get about 12 minutes each. That does not ever happen, right? We usually see some of the front runners kind of suck up the oxygen. And so I think that that's a problem. And then also, you know, to the Yang issue, you have candidates who are really sort of more one-issue candidates, and they're going to want to speak about that issue. I think it's going to be interesting to see how the folks who have put out more broad policy platforms and are trying to really, you know, cover their bases around the fact that you can't be president and only care about one issue. Like, how do they balance that, and what opportunities are they given to really make the case, especially with someone like Elizabeth Warren, who has such detailed policy platforms? I think what she's probably going to be fighting for is to really, you know, boil those down into things that she can answer within the limited time that they're each given, and make the case, even though you don't have that sort of depth of detail that you're given if you're in, see, a town hall situation.
Well, Monica writes, I'm all in for Elizabeth Warren, have followed and admired her for decades, so thrilled she's running. Farzan writes, I believe candidates agree on 80% of the issues. What would be a litmus test would be the Israel-Palestine issue and their position. Do hope it gets brought up tonight.
I bet you some of them hope it's not brought up tonight.
And Ron writes, who can beat Trump? That's the most important question to answer with these debates. Another listener writes, given that the next president's hands will be tied if the Republicans retain control of the Senate, isn't it about who could make the best case against the GOP in general? Any other policy differences seem moot in comparison? Melanie Mason, I mean, what do you think this means in terms of whether or not that means you go moderate or you tack left and go more progressive in terms of who can beat the president, who can, you know, make a case to the Republicans?
I think that this is this debate that's sort of raging among the Democratic electorate right now, which is how do you define electability? Mm-hmm. And I think there's various theories of sort of what general election victory looks like for a Democrat. And I think that there are folks that are maybe looking at that more maybe moderate centrist tack and saying you've got to win back people who had flipped from Obama to Trump. Look at those Midwestern states, kind of white working class voters. And so perhaps you need somebody like a Biden or even a Sanders who actually does have strong appeal perhaps in those in that voting group. But then I think that there's others that say, look, part of the reason that Hillary Clinton lost is because she didn't energize her base, and that in some of these key states like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, you actually saw black voters and voters of color drop off in numbers in the cities, places like Detroit. And so instead of maybe thinking of how you win back the white working class voter, maybe it's how you energize a black voter in Detroit. And that might be a very different candidate. You know, one of the things that we've been doing at all of these events is asking voters, how do you define electability? And the thing that strikes me so much is that the answers are all over the place. So I think Democratic voters desperately want someone that's electable, but I don't think that there's consensus on what that is.
So, Melanie Mason, you are in Miami. What's the energy like?
It's a circus. This is what we expected. This really does feel like an inflection point in the campaign, because this really is the first moment where we have an official Democratic Party sanctioned debate. You get all of at least the major candidates. There are some that did not qualify for various reasons. But it feels like this is sort of this watershed moment in which maybe we will see the dynamics of the race change. Now, I would like to say I actually have fairly low expectations for the reasons Marisa laid out. There's too many people on stage, but it still feels like there's a lot of anticipation, and that leads to a lot of energy.
Melanie Mason, politics reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marisa Lagos, politics correspondent for KQED and co-host of KQED's Political Breakdown podcast. Thanks as well.
Always a pleasure, Mina.
And thanks to our listeners for your questions and comments. I'm Mina Kim. Another Hour of Forum is next. Stay with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.